Well, hello again, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And today we're going to be talking about the season one episode, Darkness Falls. Classic.
Yeah.
But before we get to that, let's read the tweets of the week.
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay, tweets of the week. These were in response to our episode from a couple weeks ago, our top 10 Doggett moments. And this really brought out the Doggett fans, I think, which was great. And maybe not everyone a Doggett fan, that's fine too. So, but lots of good responses, and I appreciated it. Tanya said, I've just finished listening to the episode today. Great reviews of most iconic Doggett moments. Thought I wasn't going to make it, as you predicted in the beginning, but actually turned out pretty good. I didn't remember how many good moments he had through seasons 8 and 9. Exactly right, Tanya. I might just add one moment I think you didn't get to mention. In the episode Dead Alive, the end scene when Doggett opens Mulder's room at the hospital and just sees how happy Scully is with Mulder, he just steps back, like realizing how much Mulder and Scully are meant to each other. That is a great Doggett moment, isn't it, Annie?
Yeah.
When he just kind of realizes, okay, there's no place for me here right now. This is about them. That they have something special that I'm not part of.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that moment. I think it's important because it's almost like a transitional now moving on from the Scully Doggett partnership. We're officially moving back to Mulder and Scully. It's like a passing of the torch moment. I really think it's a good one. So yeah, nice call there.
Yeah, good one. Thanks, Tanya. Kendra said, I love Doggett and I love this episode. My fave moment is the hospital scene at the end of Permanum, especially when he leans in and tells Scully, I said I would help you. I told you we'd find him. He cares so much and wants her to trust him. I love his intensity here. That's a great one, Kendra. I really love that moment, too. What do you think about that one, Annie?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to remember. That's one like where he kind of that's where he finds out she's pregnant, right? Like he's aware of it at that point.
I think so. Yeah.
Because I
do love the intensity when he says, I told you we'd find him. Yeah. He's kind of really bolstering her faith and her spirits. And he is like, you know, he brings the intensity that maybe at that moment she's starting to lose.
Yeah.
And he kind of brings it back for her. And I love that.
He's being a very good partner. And yeah,
he is
what we want to see.
We love that. Doggett is a good partner. Now, Monica Filefan has this to say. Yes, Jen, the water in the face scene felt so damn good. OMG. Emotions were thrumming without Mulder anyway. And then poor Scully was struggling to just keep herself together. And then he hurts her feelings. Nope. I really did not like him for a few eps at least. Yeah, I think Monica's very much summed up my feelings too. Didn't like him for a few eps, but he is a good guy.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
It's a fair assessment, I would say. Esther says, Annie holding forth on cat person energy and the total illogic of Raze's flirting attempt, best X-Files Diaries moment of all time, ? I felt spoken for, supported, and vindicated. Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty great. Thanks, Esther. Esther also says, I have trouble buying Raze as a heterosexual woman. I might have said that because I do have that trouble. And Esther agrees with that. The writer's original intention to make her gay still comes through in Annabeth's performance, so much so that I've always interpreted her coming on to Doggett as comphet, which I have to confess is not a word that I'm familiar with. Is it like overcompensating heterosexuality or something like that? I got to look that one up on Urban Dictionary.
Yeah.
Raze trying to be attracted to a man.
Yeah.
I think that Esther's kind of nailed it there because that's kind of the vibe I get from that too, actually. So,
yeah. I agree.
Yeah, absolutely. And Esther also liked another line that one of us, I think Chris Carter's forte is poor choice of language. And Esther says that must be one of the sickest burns I've heard on this show. Yeah, I can't remember exactly why we said that, whether we were talking specifically about like what he says to the press, which, yes, is often poor choice of language, or like with his writing being poor choice of language. I can't remember. That was a pretty sick burn, though. Esther's right about that.
I'm going to have to re-listen because I don't remember. Sounds like something we could have said in either case, to be honest. So,
yeah. It's not untrue. I mean, I agree with us. I think we were right about that. Erica said, the cat person dog person conversation had me laughing on my drive to work. Well, that's Erica. That's, we can't hope for more than that. I agree, dog. It seems like a dog person on the outside, but really a dog would do much for him. I could imagine Mulder as a cat person too. Mm. And please, Skinner would have a fluffy cat for sure.
Oh, I love that.
I love the idea of Skinner and the fluffy cat.
Yeah.
And you know what? I think Erica might be right about that.
I actually do. I could see that. I could see that being a thing.
I can see that too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I can see Mulder as a cat person too. Like cats, I think, are like, you know, just one or two steps above fish. So, you know, fish are like, you know, the very sort of mellow, non-demanding pet. And then cats are sort of a little bit closer in that category than dogs are. So I can definitely see that working.
I agree. And I mean, the way that Mulder even reacts to Queequeg, I mean, Mulder's pretty clearly not a dog person.
Yeah, that's true. He never really bonded with Queequeg. It was really Mulder's loss, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Ben says, I actually really like John Doe. It's one of my favorite season 9 episodes. Robert Patrick is great in that episode, especially when he remembers that he has a son and that he died. You know what? Ben's right. That moment, I think, is quite sort of well acted. And Doggett does get a chance to kind of do a bit more. And Robert Patrick gets a chance to do a bit more in terms of like bringing the emotion, because he's usually, you know, so very kind of like, you know, level-headed. That's part of Doggett's way. But he gets to be a little bit wackadoodle in this episode and gets to have that more sort of emotional punch. I think Ben's onto something. That's actually quite nice. And I can see why you would like it. We were a little hard on that episode, but
yeah,
I get it. I get it though. Absolutely. Kathy G says, this was a fun episode and I love your lists. One of my fave dog moments is in The Truth when they helped Mulder escape and Mulder says, none of you will be safe now. And Doggett responds, you let us worry about that. It's brief, but it really shows us what a stand-up guy he is. That is really true, Kathy. I love that moment, actually, where he's like, yeah, you let us worry about that. That is such a great sort of Doggett kind of concept that he's like, you know, you don't worry about me.
Right.
I got this.
We can take care of ourselves.
You can just rely on Doggett 100%.
Yeah.
You just really always get that, and you never have to worry about him.
Mm-hmm.
He's just there. To help out. And you don't worry what he's going to do. He's just a solid, solid guy. So I love that. That's actually a really great line. It's a great line for him to have in that final episode, in that final scene, I guess. It might be one of his final lines that we hear from him, which is very apropos.
Yeah, I think that actually is. It makes me wonder how the dynamic would have been. I mean, I know we got it a little bit in VNN, but like how the dynamic would have been with Doggett and Mulder as partners, like early in the series, like when with early Mulder and his sort of like, I'm going to go rogue attitude, like how would Doggett have responded to Mulder back in the day? I feel like that would have been really interesting dynamic to watch.
That's a really interesting question. I kind of like that idea. I mean, I like the idea of Doggett with Mulder, you know, at every stage of the series, you know, even in season 8, I think they were really interesting together. Early Mulder and Doggett would have been Doggett was already pretty flummoxed by Scully, and Scully was like, you know, like a 3 out of 10 on the crazy scale compared with Mulder. And so I can only imagine how baffled Doggett would have been by Mulder. It would have been interesting. They would have made an interesting pair. I think we can maybe see some fanfic about this.
He wouldn't have been indulgent in the same way, like as he was with Scully. So, I mean, yeah, I just find that fascinating.
Yeah, he wouldn't have been quite as sort of mesmerized by Mulder as he was by Scully. And why wouldn't you be mesmerized by Scully? I sure as heck would be. Isadub said, great Doggett moments. I love another moment, or rather scenes, in Alone when Doggett has to team up with Layla Harrison. At first, Doggett is pissed off by her, but very soon he's taking care of her and treats her like a partner and not judging her. I think Isadub's right about that part. I think Alone is an underrated episode, and Doggett is very sort of like fair, I think, with Agent Harrison in that episode. So I like that. Isadub also adds one more thing. I'm with Jen about Doggett's accent. Maybe not for the same reason. Non-English native, I find it very hard to understand Doggett. Luckily, I watch the episodes with the English subtitles on. Yeah, I can see that. It is a weird accent. And yeah, I think it would be quite a challenge to understand if, I mean, I had trouble understanding it occasionally. So I'm sure as a non-English speaker, it would definitely be a challenge to pick up on.
Yeah.
And I find myself, maybe it's something to do with getting older. I leave the closed captioning on quite often a lot of the times now.
Yeah.
When I'm watching even the X-Files, when I know all the dialogue, but it's just kind of like, just that way I don't have to worry about missing anything.
Well, it sinks in better. I think everybody should watch with the captions at least once. Everybody should.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just like, it's a different way that your brain absorbs information because, you know, we do it one way through our ears, but reading it, it does sort of help us to sort of, it sinks in on a different level. So there's something to be said for that. You're right. Emily says, I'm going to have a lot more to say about this episode, but I did want to start by admitting that it also took me forever to recognize James Bicken Jr. as the actor who also played Chief Webber in Grey's Anatomy.
Oh, thank yay! You, somebody else.
Thank God it wasn't just us. She says, I'm fairly face blind, so I have these moments a lot, but that one blew me away more than most. He did a good job of making himself malicious as Kirsch that I didn't see it at all. Exactly, right, Emily? Mm-hmm. Emily also clues us in that she says, I need to put Ghosts of Mississippi into my Before They Were in the X-Files movie series because he played a young Medgar Evers. I did not know that.
Oh.
About. I've not seen Ghosts of Mississippi, but I mean, you know, I'm a fan of James Bicken Jr., so I'll watch anything that he's in at this point.
Well, I think
he's
Emily
very talented.
Answered our question is we're not stupid. He's just a really good actor.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. This is a credit to him and not a knock on us by any means.
Right.
And Jessica wraps things up by saying, Annie is an introvert? Is that a test to see if we're listening? She also adds on, my favorite moment is Roadrunners, especially the first half, doggedly looks for Scully, even when she's pushing him away, just like she's done for Mulder for forever. Excellent point about Doggett and Roadrunner. Interesting about the complete disbelief, apparently, that Annie could possibly be an introvert. You and I have talked about this, Andy, because I consider myself, I mean, I am very, I'm a pretty extreme introvert, actually. So
yeah.
I remember one day we both realized we were introverts, and I said, what are we doing, two introverts hosting a podcast?
Well,
but somehow introverts are complex.
Well, and it makes sense to me that we would be doing a podcast because it's not like we're in a crowded room of people. We're literally talking to each other. And I am cool talking to one person. I could do whatever I want to do. And it's not like I have a problem with crowds. I just prefer to be alone. And I think there are a vast variety of introverts. No, it wasn't a test to answer your question. I really am an introvert. But I'm just a rather outspoken introvert. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right that introversion can come in many forms. I think that introversion and shyness are not necessarily the same thing.
Oh, absolutely not. No.
And a lot of the times people kind of, because there are a lot of shy introverts and a lot of introverted shy people. But, you know, I can be shy in some circumstances, but I don't generally consider myself a shy person. I don't cope well with like a lot of people, generally speaking. And I find it very tiring dealing with a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. I always hit a wall. Like I hit a wall where I'm like, I'm done. I need to go back and be by myself. Like I can't.
Exactly.
And it's not necessarily like a discomfort. It's just I think it's more of a preference. Like
exactly.
You know, I have arrived at the moment where I am no longer enjoying this. That's kind of where I'm at. And it's not, it's not like it gives me anxiety or anything like that.
Right.
It's just a preference.
Exactly. I think I remember hearing one of the best explanations I heard of the difference between extroverts and introverts is that, generally speaking, extroverts get energy from being around people, and introverts they feel that drain, being around people drains their energy.
That's a really great description, and I would agree with that completely.
Yeah. Because it always kind of baffles me, some people that are like, yes, let's get together, I really want to, and they really want to, like, they can't wait to throw parties again and stuff, and I'm like, really, do you? Because you know, the pandemic and, you know, spending a lot of time alone and away from work and away from crowds, it's just kind of really, my introversion has just really sunk right in, and it's hard to kind of get out of it a little bit now, but I am working on it.
Yeah, I do feel it too, especially when you get used to it and then you have to get back into it. I feel like my threshold is even shorter or
honestly
closer. What's the proper way?
I don't know, but it can be.
You know what I mean.
I do. I do know what you mean.
So
I know. Yeah. I hear you. We got slightly off of the X-Files there, but I thought it was such an interesting question about introversion and extroversion. I'd love to hear from our listeners where they stand and where they fall in the introversion and extroversion. I have a theory that fandoms are populated more by introverts than extroverts, yeah. but I'd like to see whether that's true or not, because I think that fandom tends to attract introverts, but mm-hmm. I could be wrong about that. So, you know, do feel free to weigh in on that. And do, as always, weigh in on anything X-Files related to at our Twitter account at XFD Podcast. And look forward to seeing you there.
Mulder, the internet is not good for you.
All right, Jen, we're going back in time here. Season one, Darkness Falls.
Kind of a
I don't know, somewhat popular monster of the week. I'm actually not sure, but I mean, I know most people remember it.
I think it is
pretty distinct.
Yeah.
And I can't think of any other ones besides Detour that like take place in the woods in this way, like, and then it has like an actual creature like in the woods like this. So I don't know. I'm trying to think of this monster is very unique, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Yeah. I wrote down on my notes, it's the woodsiest of the woodsy episodes, and definitely. I like that a lot about it.
Yes. Directed by Joe Napolitano? I'm sorry if I'm saying that wrong. Who also directed Jersey Devil, just to put it in there. Written by Chris Carter. And you apparently have done a little bit of research, right? You've done a little bit of Googling, Wikipedia-ing to give us some tidbits. Let's hear it.
I have done a little bit of Googling and Wikipediaing about this episode, and I didn't really think I was going to find much, because sometimes, you know, I have a look around and there's really nothing much to say. But this was quite interesting. I did not know all of this about Darkness Falls. When I was watching the episode this week, another thing I wrote in my notes was this: all of this rain and woods, it looks like it must have been a hellish episode to film. And indeed, apparently it was. Bad weather plagued production, and it was allegedly one of the toughest episodes of the season for the crew. Weather delayed production at the site, so they had to do like pickup shots after the fact. Apparently there was also delays because they were actually filming it in quite a remote location. And so they had to commute staff in every day into this sort of like forest location. So it was actually, you know, I guess to find, you know, the big old growth forest and like the logging locations and things like that. They didn't just film this on like, you know, the edge of a park somewhere in downtown Vancouver. This was pretty remote. So that was interesting. And so that caused, you know, logistical problems as well.
Well, it felt that way. You know, when I'm watching it, it that's interesting that you say that, because I did not know that. But it really does feel like you're really deep in the woods. Like a lot of those scenes were like, especially like the one where they're kind of walking through and they see all the cut trees. And it's just it feels like they're like in the middle of the mountains somewhere, like they're very far. So they did a really good job with the location scouting.
Yeah, for sure. It definitely. I mean, location's everything in this episode, right? So they went all out with that. And so that was impressive. According to the 1999 book X Marks the Spot on location with the X-Files, the atmosphere amongst many of the crew had grown quite tense towards the end of the shooting schedule. And it culminated in a heated argument between director Joe Napolitano and first assistant director Vladimir Stefanov, after which Napolitano did not appear on location again. And Darkness Falls was the last episode of the series that he directed. So, I mean, I don't know exactly what their source is on all of that drama, but I mean, intriguing if true. So I don't know quite exactly what all. I mean, it is true. That was Napolitano's last episode, though that could be for like many, many different reasons, but intriguing. So I think what we could certainly take from all of this is that it was a challenging shoot.
Yeah, it seems like this show in general like had a lot of those sorts of like overtime, spending way too many late nights. Like it just seems like this show was kind of plagued with that. So I believe it.
Yeah,
I believe it.
Well, yeah. And especially, you know, in the first season, you know, they didn't necessarily have the resources that they had in later seasons, too.
Right.
So they were just winging it a lot of the time and probably made for difficult conditions a lot of the time.
I mean, the good thing is that it led to quality production of television. I mean, and it shows. So I guess in the end, the means the end justified the means in this case, I suppose. But I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if I would have felt the same if it were me working that strenuously. So.
Oh, my God. Just watching some of those rainy scenes, I'm like, God, that just looks miserable.
Yeah.
But I mean, all of this was a surprise to me because, I, you know, I'd watched Darkness Falls many times. And it never, like you say, it looks good on screen. There was nothing about that episode that ever made me think, well, this episode's clearly a mess. I mean, you watch an episode like, you know, Tezos Dos Bichos, for example. That episode is a tiny bit of a mess. And I mean, they kind of knew it at the time when they were filming, not in this kind of like, you know, conflict drama way, but just like, you know, a bit of a mess. And I don't get that feeling at all watching Darkness Falls. They obviously made the best of what they had and yeah. whatever editing they had to do well. So I don't get the feeling that it doesn't look problematic. So whatever issues they had, they did a good job of covering them up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also random trivia, Jason Bengg, who plays Ranger Larry Moore, was a childhood friend of David Duchovny. Did not know that.
Ah.
But now I do.
He played which character?
Ranger Larry Moore, the
federal,
main,
yeah.
The Federal Forest Service guy.
Right.
And so apparently they did their best to try to keep things, you know, light on the set between Duchovny and Larry Moore, since they were both sort of friends already. So they were doing their best to kind of get people through the slog. So
nice.
That, you know, that's that noble attempt on their part.
I liked that character. So,
yeah, right. I find him, he's an appealing actor. I remembered him. I was trying to think where I'd seen him before, but he had had quite a long stint on Melrose Place. So there's some more of my 90s TV taste being revealed.
I love it.
Last piece of random trivia. The episode was honored at the 4th Annual Environmental Media Awards in 1994, Environmental Media Awards, winning the Television Episodic Drama category. So there we go. I did not know there was such a thing as the Environmental Media Awards. I don't know if there still is. I'd be surprised, but you never know. There might be. And this one won, interestingly enough. And I'm sure we'll get into sort of a discussion about the sort of environmental aspects of the episode, but it was well regarded apparently by people who are interested in environmental issues in media. So there we go.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that makes sense to me. And I do like kind of a lot of the things they had to say in this. And I feel like there were a lot of bits in this that I found rather educational. So
yeah.
Well done. Well done, Darkness Falls. Okay. Well, let's jump right in, Jen. What do you say?
Yeah.
So this cold open is, you know, it's funny. It's not a great cold open because
isn't it?
Well, because we see a lot of the same stuff, I guess, later. I don't know. This is the logging crew. So we find out later. I don't know. I didn't hate it or anything. I'm just like, I was just kind of, I don't know. It was weird because they split up. First of all, I don't think this split up every man for himself plan seems very smart. I was just like, what are y'all thinking? Like, I get it that everybody's scared, but it was just like, what is everybody doing? Are they just like, it was like chaos. They're just like scampering around. Like, I don't know. It did not seem like a very good plan. I did not like it. You know, whatever happened to live together, die alone. Sorry. I mean, that's a Lost reference, but it's just, y'all, this is not going to work. It's not good. And then what I thought was also really funny was that we have this giant group of people and then we end up with the two guys that were fighting that are like buddies, like they're together now. Like, what happened to everybody else? Why were they teamed up?
Right.
It didn't make any sense to me. I actually had to go back and watch it again because I was like, wait, is that the same guy? Why are they hanging out? They were just hating on each other. I don't know. It was weird. I just found it weird.
Yeah, I only just recognized tonight, actually, when I watched it for the second time this week, that those were the same two guys that had been fighting at the beginning. Part of me thinks it was just a question of, like, economy. Like, we're already paying these actors to have lines, so we might as well use them again.
Yeah.
But I think it was just kind of maybe an illustration of, you know, it was nothing personal. Everyone was just trying to do the best they could in a panicky situation, and push come to shove, they're still kind of there for each other. But I think the only way you can kind of explain the general sort of odd and perhaps not great choices is just the general panic. They're just like freaking out. Everyone's running every which way. Maybe there was this thought that if we spread apart, then the bug will go after somebody, but maybe it won't be me. And if we stay together, they might get us all.
Yeah.
But if we spread out, then, you know, some of us might have a chance.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I can see the logic in it, but it didn't feel that way when I watched it. Like, it felt like there was no logic applied to this decision. It just felt like chaos. So, you know, we can look back in hindsight and be like, hey, maybe that was a smart idea. Like, who knows what happened to all the rest of them? I guess, did Mulder say they all disappeared? I was so distracted by Mulder and Scully's adorable flirting that I find myself sometimes not paying attention. And I think that this happens to the best of us, right?
This happens to me every time. I had to really, like, I don't think I've ever actually noticed before what he was actually saying in that slideshow. But yes, they all disappeared. So one assumes that these ravenous bugs got them all.
Yeah, so their plan did not work in the end. So
it did. I mean, I don't think anything would have.
I agree. I mean, and that's what it comes down to, is like, I'm making fun of them for this terrible plan, but they were all dead anyway. So what am I? Who am I to judge? Yeah. You know? So,
I mean, I wouldn't have lasted more than, 10 minutes out there. So,
yeah. Well, let's talk about this adorable office scene, because it's funny. When I think of like classic Mulder slideshows, like, this is one of the ones that leaps to the front of my mind.
Yeah.
And let me tell you why, Jen. Okay. Right. This is one of my favorite bits, because he's showing her the slides and she's like, a captive audience as usual. And then she's like, what happened to them? And then he clicks and there's a blank slide and he goes, they vanish. And he put that blank slide in just to impress Scully with his adorable, like, presenting of this. I just love it. And then he goes right back to the slideshow. It's like, Mulder, we know what you did. You put a blank slide, or you put a no slide. There's like an empty little slot there just so that you could do that. I love it.
I never noticed that there were more slides after the empty missing slide. I always kind of thought that was the end of the slideshow, but came at a good time. But now I realize, yes, he did that on purpose, just to kind of boom, have a punchy impact.
Yeah, it's so funny. It made me think of, like, the pilot, when he'd be like, how does that grab you? Like, he loves his little slideshows, and he just loves, and you could tell Scully loves them too, because she's just sitting there loving every minute of this. It's very, very cute. And this is so early too.
There's like there's something about the slideshows that brings out the flirty side of both of them.
Yeah. I don't know. I just really love it. And I think that this is a really well, I think it's a really well-written episode. I think it's laid out really well. I think all of the stuff going on, other than, the chaos and the people being stupid and the cold open that I just brought up, is pretty well thought out and pretty solid. Like, I think overall it's a pretty well conceived episode. I really like the idea that, like, Mulder has all this information. He's like, okay, well, it could have just been a missing persons case, but I have these receipts that this happened in 1934. And that only Mulder would know that, this is the kind of case that only Mulder would follow up on. And I love when they throw in stuff like that. That's like, this is clear that this is in the X-Files basement for a reason, because Mulder has given it a reason,
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, like, how did he even know about this 1934 thing? And how did he put the pieces together when he heard about what was going on today in Washington? Did he think, oh, that reminds me of an X-Files that I read about from 1934? Like, how does he make these connections?
They always say that he has a really great memory. This makes me think of what we were talking about last time, when Doggett's like, well, I don't have a memory for mucus. I'm like, well, Mulder sure does. That's his specialty. So, it seems like he just has the stuff cataloged in his brain and he can remember it. I believe it, because this is just very Mulder. Like, he's super obsessed with all of this stuff. So it makes sense.
Yeah, it really does. He is the X-Files. He can remember them all. And he has, like, this exceptional talent for making connections. And that's how he's able to figure this stuff out.
Yeah. So, of course, we have the classic line of, come on, Scully, it'll be a nice trip to the forest, which is one of my favorite Mulder lines. It's just very cute. It's like, he does whatever he can to just convince her. And if he's got to turn on the charm, he's going to do it. I love it.
He does. And I like the fact that he's not just telling her they're going to go. He does still want to, like, convince her that she wants to come with him. I mean, at this stage, kind of in their partnership, he probably could have just said, as he did, basically in the pilot, here's your plane ticket, we're going tomorrow. And that's, she still would have gone. But I appreciate the fact that he wants her to want to come, and that he does really want to sort of, you know, convince her and wants her to enjoy it and to be happy and excited just like he is.
Yeah, I like that too. And that's a nice progression on Mulder's end. We see the progression throughout season one on Scully's end. Like, we see it like in her, you know, canceling dates and doing this and like, and her slowly sort of turning her life over to the X-Files and to Mulder. But it's nice to see, like you said, on Mulder's end, like he is sort of recognizing that this is a job, but it's not just a job to him. And hopefully it's not just a job to her. And yeah. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's great.
Do you have anything else to say about this basement scene before we go back up to the mountains?
I mean, I do love the moment when Mulder suggests that Scully may possibly find a boyfriend amongst those lumberjacks.
How flirty was that?
Honestly,
super flirty.
And yeah. She's like, she's just smiling about that. She finds that hilarious.
Yeah, she's charmed by him. And let's remember, just a few episodes before this, he showed a great deal of interest in her. Her previously dating her professor or whatever, her instructor. And he was like, oh, and the onion peeled. I don't know, what did he say about the layers peeling? I don't know. But he's just very interested in, like, what's going on with Scully? She got a boyfriend? What's going on? Like, it strikes me as, like, he's, like, digging. Like, he's trying to, you know, it's just very cute, and I like that.
It does feel a bit like, you know, so, do you have a boyfriend? Yeah. Are you looking for a boyfriend? Could I be one of those boyfriends? Yeah, it's an interesting thing to bring up, and it's cute, but it does feel kind of like, you know, trying to sort of suss out the situation here. So
definitely
very cute, and I love the Bigfoot references as well, which of course we get. I don't know if we get another Bigfoot reference again until season 10 with the Were Monster. No, Lost Art of Forest Sweat.
Is it
season 11 when
when he does his
when Mulder's
squatching? Yeah, you're right.
I don't know if we hear about Bigfoot again in that period of time. And for those that may not be as intimately familiar with Bigfoot as apparently I'm revealing myself to be, Bigfoot and Sasquatch are the same thing. I gotta say, Bigfoot was very big in like the 80s, 90s, especially like in the 80s when I was like maybe a teenager. We were all like terrified that Bigfoot was gonna like show up at our house or something. It was just, there was just a lot about Bigfoot in the media back then. So it doesn't surprise me that it showed up in an X-Files episode. I'm only surprised it didn't happen more often. But Scully still finds it all very amusing.
I just remember Harry and the Hendersons. That's my only connection to Bigfoot. But like, I actually am surprised. It's one of those things that I go, how come they never did do a Bigfoot X-Files episode? I mean, they did the frickin' Mexican goat sucker. Like, why can't we do Bigfoot? Like, I don't know. It seems like a weird call, but okay.
Yeah, it's almost like that they didn't want to do the obvious things. They always wanted to pick, you know, the really sort of obscure stuff and talk about that. They didn't want to do the stuff that maybe had been overdone already or something. But I would have watched it, that's for sure.
I would have loved it. Anyway. All right. Well, let's head up into the forest, shall we, Jen? Let's take a nice trip up to the forest. I think we need to have a little bit of a fashion breakdown here. Because whenever we talk about, like, fashion on this show, this is one of the first things that just leaps to my mind. I don't know about you. But and it's Scully's parka, obviously. We're going to talk about Scully's parka. I don't have a problem with this parka. I think it's fine. Like, I look at it and it just, I think it's fine. It looks exactly like something somebody would have worn in the 90s. I think what's interesting about it is that it's got, like, almost too much character. That's like, you know what I mean? Like, it's too bright and vibrant and fun and silly for Scully. Like, and I don't even want to say, it's not like I'm saying this is out of character. It's just, again, it's like a little insight into like her private wardrobe. What does it look like? We never get to see it. Like, but here we are, we're getting to see it, and that's it. And I just find that fascinating.
It is interesting. And not only does it stand out in terms of being sort of an interesting choice for Scully compared to the rest of her wardrobe, but in this episode, like, everyone else is wearing all, like, you know, dark greens and navy blues and blacks and stuff, and there she is, and la la la, I'm in my bright forest colors. It does look odd, but I mean, I think that it certainly wasn't odd. It didn't strike me as odd at all at the time, because I think we were were all wearing jackets like that.
Exactly.
These were quite common. And I think those colors were probably really common too. So to me, it never struck me as remotely strange until maybe watching it like 20 years later,
right,
and thinking, oh God, that's what he actually wore, wasn't it? Like, I'm sure I might still have a jacket that would be very similar to that one. So yeah. I think it was just kind of, that's just, you know, what the gals wore back then.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very practical. And like, maybe it was like a Helly Hansen Gore-Tex jacket, something like that. I think someone has to, now you might know this better than I do. I'm sure I've seen people that have since found that exact jacket, and I can't quite remember which brand it wound up being, but I know that, like, you know, the folks, the fans that are into like cosplaying and costumes,
yeah,
and stuff like that have tracked down
that exact jacket. Yeah. Yeah.
So it can be found. It'd be a great way to cosplay Scully, actually, because people would definitely know exactly what it was when they saw it.
If I ever saw that in a thrift shop or something, I would definitely purchase it. I have to say, I couldn't see myself actually wearing it.
I would wear it. I mean, I have a similar jacket now. You can't go wrong with a waterproof breathable, I'm telling you.
The other thing that I would have to point out is just that it makes her look younger. Like, she already looks young, and it makes her look,
yep,
even younger. Like, that
it does.
That stood out to me as I watched.
Yeah, that jacket does make her look younger. She looks generally shorter in this episode because I guess she's not wearing heels, and so she just looks like just this adorable little child sometimes.
Yeah.
between the bright colors and the ponytail and
the little bangs,
you know, no heels, a little shorter than usual. She just looks like, you know, a teenager, and it is kind of unusual.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of fashion, let's move over to Mulder, who I have to say, I enjoy the black sweater, white turtleneck combo.
Yeah.
More of that, Mulder. We have said before on this podcast many times how much we enjoy Mulder in a turtleneck. Never going to complain about that. But he looks, I don't know, I just really like his look in this episode. He's got it going on.
He looks really good. And that was, and that particular combination also kind of says 90s to me as well. And he does look very good in it.
Right. And like the guy, what's his name? The Humphreys, the asshole guy. I'm like, what's that guy? He's got like this denim button down too. Like, I don't know. I remember, what would that be called? Chambray, like a chambray shirt.
Which
also
like that.
Very 90s. I had to point that out. Is it only chambray if it's a woman wearing it? I don't know.
I don't know.
But
I mean,
like, to me,
I think Scully is rocking the gigantic denim shirt in this episode for sure.
Yeah.
I think
hers is definitely chambray.
It's huge. But again, we wore huge shirts back then. I have a few huge shirts from those days.
I just remember it was like the baggier the better.
Yeah, I mean, that's the truth. It really was. I mean, I think back to the shirts that we wore. I mean, you see it now. If anyone watches Friends these days, you see kind of the same styles of that kind of casual clothes. And the thing that I notice now when I watch Friends now is, God, everyone had huge shirts. And I forgot.
Yeah,
that that's what,
especially
we wore
in those early years.
Day.
Yeah, like, because Friends would have started around the same. I think Friends started the same year as X-Files. So it's like season one and season one would have coincided. So, very, very true. Like those early seasons, I would say, like, one through three in particular, you see a lot of that. Scully also had a vest on too. I remember like vests being like a big deal.
Yeah, there were a lot of vests in the day as
a lot
well.
Of
that's
vests,
true.
Just, man.
This is all just like, this is a great like museum piece of, you know, 90s casual fashion.
This is the time capsule of this is the shit that we got away with in the 90s. I don't know. I love it. She's adorable. She's adorable in everything, so I can't fault her, but it's just,
I think she looks, both her and Mulder, I think, look cute as buttons in this whole thing. Just cute in their outdoorsy outfits. I love Scully in a ponytail. That really is an enjoyable look for me. And I think they both look great.
Yeah, I agree. Love it. Love it all. All right. Well, now that we've talked about a little bit of you know, nonsense, let's get into this plot, shall we?
Okay.
So let's introduce our players. I always really like the episodes where it's Mulder and Scully, and then it's like a couple other characters, and they're kind of caught. It's like ice, you know, it's like fire. It's like we have this new group now of people, or not fire, I meant a firewalker. But it's like this new group of people now that we're going to get to know a couple new characters. These are the ones that are probably going to die. And we're going to like kind of slowly knock them all out as we watch the episode. So we have Moore, who, as you said, was David Duchovny's friend. His name? Sorry, I had it. I had my thing up for a moment. Oh, Jason Begg.
Begg.
Yeah. Yeah. As more the ranger guy. Tom O'Rourke plays Humphreys, I would say the asshole guy. Mm-hmm. And then Titus Welliver as Doug Spinney, who he was on that, what was that Amazon show called that, I know Pat Skipper mentioned it. It was the one he was on a lot. Think of what it's called. But anyway, he was also.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, he was also on Lost. I just know him as the man in black on Lost.
Okay. Yeah, he looks familiar to me too. I don't generally enjoy men in mustaches, but I've got to say he looks very fine in a mustache.
Yeah. Yeah. Bosch is the name of the show, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah. I was like, want to look that up. But like, yeah, he was good. Of those three characters, I mean, I really, really enjoyed watching him. I thought he did a really good, interesting performance. So I just wanted to give him a shout out.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, I thought they all did a great job. I love the idea that Scully has this line when they first show up that she's like, why does it feel like we're stepping into the middle of a war? Because it's like we're up here dealing with people being murdered. And yet it's now we have to deal with like schoolyard drama, essentially. Like it obviously is a much bigger deal than that. But when it comes down to it, that's what it is. It's just like they're just being childish with each other like the entire time. Like I actually wrote a note on my notes that was like Spinney and Humphreys should just fucking get it over with.
Honestly, like they can't be in the room together without snarking at each other constantly.
Right. I mean, it would just be better for everyone if they just got out all of their bad aggression in a good way, in a positive way. Yeah,
it really would have been something. I think that fanfic is going to be coming pretty soon now. Humphreys and Spinney, little enemies to lovers.
I don't want to read it, but I like the concept. I like it in concept.
I think maybe I do. I'm not sure. Maybe I'm going to write it. I'm just feeling very inspired by this idea.
I love that. I love that. I wanted to say, too, though, because we obviously meet Moore and Humphreys before we get to Spinney, so we don't have to talk about him quite yet, but... when Humphreys is talking about like there's a lot of talk about what the environmentalist people are allowed to do and what the eco terrorists are going to come in and like prevent them, not the eco terrorists but whatever, the environmental terrorists, what do they call?
Yeah, they do call them eco terrorists. Eco terrorists. These days I think we use the term eco terrorists more likely, but that's a frequently a term they use to describe them. I think,
well, when Humphreys, he's the security head of the logging company, I guess is what his role is. But when he's telling them that like every time they cut down a tree they plant a sapling, I really, really have to be skeptical. I don't think that's happening. I don't think that man has planted a sapling in his life. I'm just putting it out there.
Yeah, it's a little hard to believe. And even if you do believe that, because I was thinking the same thing, I'm like, yeah, sure you do. And then because we're given reason to doubt Humphreys on a lot of levels. He's not a likable guy.
Right.
And so there's no reason to kind of
be on his side,
latch on to anything that he says, really. I just kind of out of spite want to disbelieve everything that he says.
Yeah.
And I was also thinking, even if they are somehow planting saplings, that's still, there's a big difference between a sapling and like a gorgeous big old tree. And so that's not necessarily a one for one trade there.
Right. It's and like that sapling's gonna what, take 100 years to get that big? Like I mean, I don't know from trees. I don't know. I actually had to point this out too because this was one of those moments that we have occasionally when I'm like, come on, writers, like you really have to have Scully, the scientist, be the one to ask him. And these middle rings are the older rings. I'm like, you know what? We all learned that in third grade.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, like literally this is not something that needs to be explained.
Yeah, Scully's gonna ask that.
No, it bothered me so much. Like, come on.
I
like,
know.
Why the guy could have just like explained it like as if they didn't know. Yeah. I was so irritated by that. I'm glad to know you were too.
Yeah, no, that definitely stood out to me because it's like, yeah, no. I mean, it's nice that you know exactly how many insects there are in the world. That's impressive, but you don't know about how tree rings work.
I know.
It was just not the strongest moment. I don't know if we've already mentioned the fact that Chris Carter is the writer of this episode.
Oh, we did. We mentioned it, but yes.
I had kind of forgotten.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, you know, if anyone knows the characters, it's Chris Gardner, and yet he still has Scully saying that. But I guess, you know, it was all in the spirit of exposition. Still not the way I would have done it.
It's definitely in the spirit of exposition. Like, I'm not going to sit here and be like, oh my God, they must hate Scully. Like, it's very clear from the beginning of this show that Scully is supposed to be the smart one, like the scientist. So it's like, I don't understand why that was given to her. And again, I don't even, I have to see the script.
Yeah.
I would love to see the script because it could have been something that they added on the day. I don't know, because they probably were like, yeah, we need some exposition. We need to explain this to the viewer, because clearly our viewers didn't learn this in third grade, even though they all did. but it was just, it really kind of drew me out of it. I was like, there could have been a better way to do this, guys.
Yeah.
Come on.
There had to be a better way, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was some kind of production related reason, like Duchovny had left for the day or something by the time they were filming that line.
It does seem like something Mulder could have believably asked. Like, I mean, I still would have been like, Mulder,
like,
you
more
should...
More believably than Scully.
More believably than Scully. Like, I might not have bumped on it in the same way if Mulder had delivered that line.
Yeah.
So, but Scully the scientist would know that. So that was annoying. No. But anyway.
Yeah, just a distraction.
Yeah, it was distracting. Yes. But yeah, so let's carry on here. So they find the cocoon, right?
Yes, yes.
This is a really cool... kind of scary scene. And I'm wondering, like, to Jillian getting to go up and, like, do the little, like, the hanging and the poking and the cutting and all that, like, but she's, like, so close to this prop cocoon and doesn't seem to be too bothered by it. And I mean, we know it's a prop, but, like, if this were, like, a real gigantic insect cocoon, she seems awfully close to it for me. Like, I'm like, that is literally almost touching your cheek. Like, I feel like Scully, I mean, she looks disgusted, like her facial expressions look kind of grossed out, but I'm like, you're too close to this. Back up. You're like, your face is too close to it. I don't know.
Yeah, really. And I mean, it's clearly a very, you know, whatever has killed this man is some kind of a deadly force. How does she know for sure that it's gone?
Exactly.
Like, there could still be something in there that's going to come after her, but she's a pretty cool customer.
Right. I mean, and once she sees the fingers, she's not a cool customer anymore. But then we cut to commercial. So, like, we don't really find out how they got from A to B. I would have just been very curious to know how exactly they got it down, because don't we cut back and it's already down?
Yeah. They do. Yeah. It does feel a little bit like something is, you know, left there. And that scene does end just a little sooner than I wanted it to.
Yeah. I did think it was pretty funny how she's like, it's a male. And Mulder's like, barely. I was just like, Mulder, come on. This is no time for joking about dick size. Come on.
Mulder never passes up a chance to make a comment / joke about genitalia, does
it's he? True. It's true. And you know what I love about it is that later in the episode, or not later in the episode, later in the series, like, Scully sometimes can't help doing it either. It's almost like it's rubbed off on her. I find that really funny.
No pun intended, it's rubbed off on
her. Sorry, I can't help myself. Anyway, lots of science talking here going on. They're trying to figure out how it's been down there or up there, how long it's been up there. They said that this guy seemed like he was embalmed. Like it was almost like whatever these bugs can do can embalm you, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Like, I think Scully says, it's like desiccated, like all of the, her explanation is that all the fluids have been taken out of him. It's a very good prop, right? That body is really terrifying and literally does look like a human with all of the fluids taken out of it. So kudos to them for that.
Yeah. It's a good one. But they immediately say that, like, they think it looks like an insect cocoon. And it's funny because I like Mulder's face. As soon as he says that, like, you see the wheels start turning in Mulder's head and he stands up and he's like, oh man, are we dealing with a big fucking bug? That's so cool. Like, you can just totally see it. And I don't know. I love that. I love that.
Yeah. He's definitely intrigued.
Yeah. So they get back up, they get up to the camp, and just to, you know, bear with me here, but, like, this is the camp that of the loggers, correct? That got disappeared. And it seems like the eco terrorists have, you know, come and, like, sabotaged and ruined everything and put rice in their tanks and just to try and, I guess, keep them up there. I'm not sure. I don't know. Just to fuck with them, I guess.
Yeah. I guess, yeah, I was a little unclear about the sequence of events because The loggers all, you know, took off because of the bugs. We know about that.
Mm-hmm.
We also know that, yeah, their vehicles have all been screwed with, which, of course, you know, is convenient to the plot because they can't find a way of getting out. But
exactly.
Yeah, we are to assume that it's these, what did they call them again? Like monkey wrenchers? Monkey
yeah.
something?
I think they said yeah. monkey wrenchers that, a couple times. Yeah.
Yeah, monkey wrenchers that did this. I don't imagine they did it after the loggers had disappeared because that would seem like a strange thing to be doing. So I kind of guessed they had just done it at some point.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that Spinny was supposed to be going there to steal a car battery, right? So I don't know if he kind of thought, hey, while I'm here, I'm going to screw with your vehicles. But I don't know exactly when he would have done that.
It doesn't make any sense because he already is afraid.
Well, exactly. So I don't see him hanging around doing that kind of stuff.
Right. Like he wants to get out of there just like everybody else. So I think what you were saying yeah. about the sequence of events, I think it's like this is something that they're just trying to show the viewer that like these guys are troublemakers too. Like this isn't like a one-sided debate. We're going to show both sides. You know, yeah. that's kind of how I read it. Like we got to see the bad parts yep. of these environmental quote unquote tree huggers.
Yes.
So I don't know. I feel like it works yeah. in that regard. So
I think so. Yeah. I mean, whether it was something that happened, it could have happened like a week beforehand. Those loggers might be up there for months at a
right.
time. Who knows?
Yeah.
So it could have happened at any point. And yeah, it's just another way of sort of illustrating, you know, oh my, these guys, you know, they may have a noble cause and the loggers might be doing some bad stuff, but, you know, they're also being jerks too. So, you know, and it does serve the plot in terms of making it so that they're stuck up there.
Yeah. Spinny is actually very helpful to progress the plot along here because he's the one who sort of tells them that he saw this quote unquote monster or whatever it is. And now with the evidence that they have already found, they're sort of putting together the fact that, okay, wow, there's some actual scary shit going on up here. But he also has the helpful information about like the light, right? The darkness, how the darkness is,
yeah.
how they swarm and stuff.
But
I really like this scene in the cabin when they're all just kind of sitting around and talking about, you know, their different viewpoints on it and how they each are breaking the law and like are we breaking the moral laws or are we breaking the actual legal laws and I don't know, I found this whole conversation really interesting. I liked it. I like this scene.
No, it was interesting. It did kind of do a pretty economical job of sort of laying out the different sides and how each views the others. And I like the fact that more the ranger is kind of in the middle of the two.
Yeah.
Like Humphreys is kind of, you know, the extreme on the side of the loggers and Spinny's kind of the extreme on the side of the eco folks. And Moore kind of can sort of see both sides in different ways. He comes off as very reasonable
mm-hmm.
and he kind of helps, I think in a way kind of represents how maybe the viewers are meant to see it, that there's, you know, there are points on both sides.
Yeah, well, he seems almost like the middle point, too, between Mulder and Scully, in a way. Like, he's just,
yeah.
like you said, like, he's just very no-nonsense. He doesn't want to deal with this drama. He just wants to solve the case.
Yeah.
And he kind of takes a powder on it, too. Like, he doesn't really want to take a side. So, I like that. I like this character. I like how there's five characters and they kind of all have these very distinct viewpoints, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just think they did a really good job with that in this episode.
Yeah, I like the fact that there's not like a lot of extraneous characters. I
know,
like I kind of had remembered this episode as having more characters than it does. I like that everyone has a role to play and we don't have any more than we need, really. And
yeah.
So I like, it's easy to remember who's who because, you know, they all have clear and well-defined roles. And so sometimes with these kind of episodes, it's like, now, who's this guy again now? They all kind of blur together. But in this one, I find it the characters are well-developed in
mm-hmm.
the short time that they have. And, you know, they had good actors, and they are clearly defined, and we don't have too many of them. I feel like it's just a good size to have for a group like this.
Yeah, and they're all interesting to watch. So
they are, yeah.
I didn't bring this up. I meant to, and I don't remember what part it is, but I did write something on here that I thought was funny that, like, there's a point when they're walking outside where Scully is, like, looking at something and she's distracted and she just kind of bumps into Mulder. Yes. Do you know which scene I'm talking about?
It's when they first arrive at the camp.
Yeah. And it's
because I took note of that, too, just as they're arriving. And Mulder, like, stops and Scully just, she bumps into his backpack. So in my mind, my theory is that Gillian Anderson has a very good sense of where David Duchovny is at all times, mm-hmm. because, you know, that's just the way that they do their scenes. But she didn't take the huge knapsack into account. And
she wasn't counting on that.
She was wearing that and walked right into it.
Yeah. I was laughing at kind of the idea that, okay, Mulder hit his mark and Scully passed it.
Yeah.
but I think it's probably more what you're saying, because they get into this comfortable like groove of where they stand, and then she's probably just spatially aware of where he is, but yeah, he's got this giant bag in the way and she's not planning on that, and just goes boop.
And Jillian's favor as well, she doesn't blink. Like,
no.
She bumps right into David. And, like, she just still stays right in the scene. And they kept that particular take. So mm-hmm. I suspect that, you know, again, that was, like, kind of a first season kind of thing where sometimes they kept imperfect takes because they didn't have an infinite number of takes. I don't know if we would have seen that in later seasons. But I love it because it's almost like a little tiny blooper right in the middle of the episode.
It totally is. But it also kind of feels slightly real. You know what I mean? Like, this is just something that might happen. You know, they're not going to always have that, like, perfect fight the future, step up onto the jilly box kind of slow, steady cam in. Like, you're not going to have that yet. So this is just like the opposite of that. And I love it.
It kind of is. I like it. I like it a lot, actually. I laugh every time it happens.
Yeah. So back into the cabin. Sorry, I took us on a little detour there, but I think it was worth it, Jen.
It was a good one. Yeah, it was good. It was a good detour.
Yeah. So Mulder is obviously, they're all spinning their theories. And I think one of the things that comes out of Gillian Anderson's mouth is a very underrated and forgotten thing, because she actually says the words brain sucking amoeba. And I think people forget about this. Right?
That is a great line. The way she says it too, right?
Yeah, it's just, and she has to say it with a straight face. I mean, I can guarantee you at this point, still in the season of making this, that Gillian and David are both like just flabbergasted every time this thing gets picked up. Because she goes home and she's like, what did I do at work today? I talked about brain sucking amoeba. Like, it's just, it's funny and it's ridiculous. And I just love it.
That is very classic X-Files.
Yeah. I mean, it was like demon fetal harvest or whatever the other. This is a classic case of demon fetal harvest.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just one of those great lines that, you know, we wouldn't get in any other show. I just love it. So the Mulder theory, which ends up, I think, being the correct one, as everything bears out, is that these bugs are actually, you know, hundreds of thousands of years old. They're ancient. And then when these trees were cut, that kind of released them. They were that they came from like being stored deep down in the volcanoes and then came up through the roots. So my question for you, Jen, do you think it's possible that this is it could be, you know, even just headcanon-y, like slightly alien related?
Well, I kind of almost kept waiting for that shoe to drop, to be honest, because there's no hint in the episode itself, I don't think, that there's anything extraterrestrial going on.
Right.
But I think certainly, I feel like in another season, there's no question we would have mentioned that it could have been extraterrestrial. I don't know if we're meant to gather that, but I mean, in the context of later seasons, I tend to think that it could be extraterrestrial because we do see that kind of concept coming up in, you know, it's a common theme, as it turns out, in the X-Files, this idea of some kind of life form being, you know, hidden, buried deep in the earth in some fashion.
Yeah.
And being brought out and that, you know, then causing mayhem. And so in the context, especially of the later seasons when we saw more of that and when it always turned out to be extraterrestrial, I think I look back on that and think of it more in that context. At the time, I don't know if we're given much to go on in terms of what could this be, except like it's something volcanic or something.
Right.
So there's not a lot. Mulder doesn't really have a particularly out there theory in this episode, really. Just that, you know, it's some kind of something from a volcano that, like you say, came up through the roots. And Scully doesn't have like a really, you know, strong counter theory to that. She's pretty on board with this, generally speaking, because to me, it isn't like super out there. It's
right.
Not a super paranormal concept. It has something of a scientific basis.
Yeah.
So they're not, even though, you know, they have their disagreements in this episode, it's not generally about what's the cause of this. They
right.
generally agree about what's the danger here and where did it come from?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting thing to point out. Also, it's like, yeah, I'm not suggesting that was intentional, that this was extraterrestrial. But I mean, they did establish as early as ICE, which would have been prior to this episode, the idea of this this extraterrestrial entity being buried, you know, being ancient and being buried deep in the earth. And I mean, like you said, we find that out later in the mythology. I don't think this has anything to do with the myth arc. But I like the idea that, like, it could have, and they just missed it. You know what I mean? Like they just didn't know it and didn't pick up on it, and it's move on to the next, you know? So it's just something I thought was interesting, and I just wanted to throw that out there as a possibility, something to mull over.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a possibility.
Yeah. So anyway, I think it's Spinny here, right, that says about the light that they don't like the light. And they always just come up with something that's super terrifying. It's like, okay, if the light goes out, we're dead, basically.
Yeah.
And it's really, really, it's terrifying. And then every time that light would flicker, it just had this really great effect that I was always kind of on edge. I mean, I just think they did a really good job building the tension here.
Yeah, they really did. Yeah, the whole concept of the light and like the light bulb being the only source and like all the great close-ups of the light bulb, which is a very sort of aesthetically pleasing light bulb to look at, I will add. And the generator, like, oh my God, the generator doesn't sound so good right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel like many of us might look back on it now and say, as I wrote on my notes, did no one have a match? Like, sure, could they not have, like, this is what we do here in Edmonton. We have a lot of mosquitoes in the summer. And so everyone's got a fire pit in their backyards to sit around in the evenings. Otherwise, you get set upon by mosquitoes. So I'm thinking, yeah, couldn't they have lit a fire to cause this? But, you know, it's one of those things that, you know what, I'm just going to set it aside. I'm going to pretend that there was, for some reason, they couldn't have a fire because the whole light thing is really well done and it is really cool.
Yeah, that's actually interesting. And I have to be honest, it's not something that crossed my mind. I have a feeling that if I were sitting there and my life depended on it, that it would cross my mind. So that's important. That's an important distinction to make. But you know what? It rained a lot. So let's just assume that like all the matches were outside and they were wet and ruined.
Let's go with that.
Let's go with that.
You know, all the wood was really wet too. So, you know, they maybe tried to light a fire and it just didn't take. We'll go with that.
Yeah. Let's just make it work, Jen. Let's make it work.
Yeah. I mean, and the fact that you didn't notice it, and that I generally didn't notice it until, you know, I think probably this week might have been the first time that I really thought about it. It goes to how well written the episode is, that we don't even question it. It's we totally buy into the universe that this story is creating.
Right. Like, it doesn't occur to me that there are options, because it's like, okay, if there were options, they would have thought of them. That's kind of where I go. It's the same. It's the same exact logic I apply when people get pissed that Mulder left in season 9. I go, okay, well, surely they exhausted all of their other options, and this was the only option they had left. I'm going to give them that benefit of the doubt. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of where my brain goes here. I'll just go, look, if there were matches, I'm sure they would have found them, but they didn't. So there weren't any matches. That's my logic.
Yeah. We'll just assume that that happened and we didn't see it.
Exactly. So, so here we go. We have the scene where they're in, this is so gross. This whole scene where like Scully sees them in the corner and they're starting to like crawl in and then the light kind of goes across her hand and you see that they're all over. Ew. Ew.
Oh.
I remember, Jen, I want you to talk about this, because I remember when we counted down a long time ago, it was like 2 years ago, when we counted down like our worst, like our favorite monsters, like actual monsters. This actually like made your list. It might have been like an honorable mention or something. But this
did.
One particularly terrified you.
It did. I mean, I don't care for bugs. And so there's that already.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, it was well done. done as an effect as well, I think. I mean, it was all mostly sort of like CGI, I think. And for, you know, for 90 CGI, I think it's pretty effectively done. And as always, the sound effects had a lot to do with it as well. So they,
the skittering.
They seemed very scary. They were, they did really well with bug sound effects on the X-Files, yeah, I have to say.
They did.
And so the sound, the effect, that's all, you know, I think very competently done. And to me, the most terrifying part is this idea. It's they're there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That just, to me, there's something, I don't know, almost primal about that, because, you know, I don't care for insects, but this idea that you're covered in them right now and you can't even tell until you see it in just the right light. I would so freak out so much more than Scully did. And so it's a really cool concept, this idea that, no, they're here right now. You just can't see them until you get this flash of them, and then like, holy shit. And so really cleverly done.
Yeah, and I also like how it almost to us looks like a, almost like a slime. Like, you see the bugs, but it also is like, Mulder's like, it's like a grime, or I think that was the word he used, because it's covering you like a film or something. But then they have this really effective, gross cut to like the actual bugs, and they're huge on the screen, and they're green, and they're just like crawling across the screen, and you see, I don't like bugs either, but like you see, okay, this isn't just like little dots, like these are little tiny bugs. And I like that one shot you get of the close-up of the bugs. It's just really scary and gross. It's
very scary, very gross. I mean, could Mulder perhaps have given Scully a little heads up that he suspected that the cabin was covered in the bugs already, so that she maybe wouldn't have freaked out quite as thoroughly as she did? It might have been nice if he had.
Yeah, I think that would have been a nice thing for him to do. But this isn't the first time this has happened. Like, I can't think off the top of my head. Oh, what was it? It was like, wasn't it Irresistible when like he didn't warn her about the graves, but because he just wanted to go to the football game? Like, just same sort of deal.
I had prepared myself before we left. Well, you should have prepared me.
Thanks a lot, asshole. Yeah. That's kind of where I
mean, you know, within the sort of context of the show, it's always beneficial if Scully doesn't know ahead of time, because it makes for a much sort of more exciting reveal if she's learning about it at the same time that the audience is, so she can kind of freak out a little bit.
Right. We have two nights, and then we have a day, and I feel like the timing of this episode's slightly confusing, because we have a day that goes by very quickly, you know, and then suddenly we're at like the next night. And talk about the, because that also kind of ramps up the tension, because, and this is another great kind of character moment for Mulder and for Mulder and Scully, because he sees that Spinney is leaving, and Spinney's telling him, I'm just trying to go and find, you know, my friends or whatever he's trying to go do, but I'll come back. And Mulder is like, okay, go. And it's just another example of Mulder wanting to trust people. And yet, you know, he says he doesn't trust anyone, but Mulder is so trusting all the time. It's just like the ultimate irony and downfall of Mulder, because he really wants to trust people. I mean, in the end, it turns out that he had the right instincts about Spinney, because he does come back. But I really think that this argument that Mulder and Scully have, it very much feels like a married couple argument to me. Doesn't it?
It does. I mean, I love it. I love it because I always love any kind of like, you know, sort of intense emotion between them, even if it's just arguing. But it's a great little argument. And yeah, it's not, I don't think that Scully disagrees with what Mulder did per se. I mean, he very readily admits that he shouldn't have done it.
Right.
And so there isn't an argument really about, did he do the right thing in letting Spinney go? The issue that Scully has is how he did it.
Right.
The fact that she says, would I have made a decision by myself that would have affected the whole group? So it's not necessarily about the decision he made. It's the way he made it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe especially without checking with her. And so she's more annoyed about how he went about it, which does feel like the kind of a married kind of an argument. It's not really about the facts of what happened, but more like, I just don't like how you did it. I don't like what it says about you and what it says about how you think about me and our relationship. And yeah, it feels very married. Mulder's a little rough on her when he says, cut the sanctimonious crap. I don't think she's being sanctimonious particularly.
No.
I'm kind of on Scully's side here.
He's being slightly petulant, but I think it's because he knows he did something wrong. I mean, they do have this really great shot of him in the foreground. Like, he's clearly like disturbed by what has happened. And this is also Scully's chance to sort of get out some probably unresolved like annoyance with Mulder doing this all the time. You know what I mean? It's kind of like you're always making decisions. You know, not that necessarily put Scully in danger. They usually are decisions that are putting Mulder in danger and sort of protecting Scully, to Mulder's credit. But she's kind of, I think her point is like, in this situation, your decision has put us all in danger, you know? And I think maybe he's kind of coming to terms with that. And I think it's just, it's a really nice scene. And he acts out, yes, but he's just as frustrated as everybody else. So.
Yeah. And it is kind of like, it also just goes to illustrate the tension of the situation. Of course, you're going to wind up having, you know, the odd little argument.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's just, everyone is just very tense.
Yeah.
Constantly and not getting much sleep. And this all kind of illustrates that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the argument plays out, you know, they have a go at each other, but then it just, you know, they just drop it, which is, you know, the way that's how that went. And ice, that's how it almost always goes with Mulder and Scully.
Yeah.
They'll have an argument, but then when it's over, it's over. And like, as soon as it ends, you know, Mulder has this lovely sort of touching of Scully's shoulder as he's heading over to the window. So he's already like reconnecting with her immediately.
Yeah. It's actually one of the more healthy arguments that they have, to be honest.
It really
because
is.
It's like they don't necessarily deal with it. They don't necessarily deal with it verbally, but he deals with it like, you know, in sort of a physical way, like like you said, like he gives her that little shoulder touch, kind of like, okay, we're cool. We're going to move on. Yeah. And we're not going to let this get in the way of our, you know, mission here, which is to survive. And then, they're probably never going to talk about it again. So.
Probably not. And I think it's really well acted by David and Jillian where, you know, as the argument is essentially comes to a close, that I'd be curious to see whether there's any sort of direction in the script for how that argument is meant to wrap up, because the way it's acted, it's very clear without them saying a word that, okay, we're fine, we're going to drop this now, and that they're both sort of like moving on, and they just do that in such a subtle way. It's really well done.
They're on the same page in this instance. It's a nice way to do it. I also like these constant cuts back to the they have to the generator, and you can like see that like the juice in the generator is getting lower and lower and lower, and like the tension, they're ramping up the tension really nicely. So then they have this lovely little scene where Mulder and Scully are just sitting on the bed, like super close. Like, why are y'all sitting so close?
Yeah, like way closer than they have to be.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's kind of comically close. It's like you're not even just sitting on the same bed. You're like, you're scooched up right next to each other. Like your heads are right. Like, it's almost like they're like, there's a camera and we got to get into the frame. You know, but that's obviously not what's happening. So it's just I just find it very amusing.
It's so sweet.
I think it's cute how he's like, are you okay? And he's like, she's like, I'm fine. Like, it's just okay. Like, no, I'm very, very not fine. But
It's like the least okay you could imagine. But, you know, she's trying. She's doing her best.
She's doing her science talk. You know, she's trying to distract them about like oxidizing enzymes and, you know, like, listen to me. I know stuff. I love it. It's cute. I like when Scully shows off for him.
I think so. And I think it's also maybe that's a way that Scully sort of, it's a self-soothing kind of behavior. Like, like, you know, if you're trying to fall asleep and you count sheep, like I bet you Scully does like scientific explanations in her head when she wants to calm down. So I think this just helps her to kind of, when she gets to have a little science talk, it just helps her to calm down and focus and get her stuff together.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I love that. And I do love in the same scene, it's like she's kind of slightly hopeless here. And Mulder is, as always, he's, you know, the hopeful one. And that I really just, I always love when that is sort of the dynamic that's playing out between them. You know, we don't talk about it often, but like that's kind of why I think the finale, season 9 finale, The Truth, I think hits so hard, because it's like one of the moments that one of the biggest moments we see Mulder kind of being on the opposite end of that throughout the episode.
Yeah.
And then, you know,
yeah,
comes back to himself at the end. But like it's scary to see him kind of being the one that's given up, you know. Mm. And so I like watching him sort of being the one to sort of buoy her and make sure that she's not giving up. I like that.
Yeah.
And we have to talk about the line here that Mulder says, which is, we'll think of something.
Yeah. Which he also says during their argument as well, which I hadn't really noticed until I watched it again, that he, you know, at the start of the argument, when, you know, Scully says, what do you suggest? And Mulder says, I don't know, we'll think of something. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, I feel like he's kind of grasping at straws at that one. But in this conversation that you're talking about now, it is more about hope, where, you know, we'll think of something. I love it because, I mean, you know, we'll think of something. It's very Mulder Scully, of course. And what I love about it is that it just, the way it illustrates Mulder's faith in the two of them together, that we'll think of something.
Yeah.
Not, you know, I'll think of something or something like that. But he really believes that the two of them together will always find a way. I mean, that's the heart of them and the heart of the X-Files in a lot of ways. So I love that. I love that phrase. And of course, you know, it very sort of like famously repeated in Plus One.
Yeah.
When Scully says it. And I'm going to have to take a more careful note at how often it gets repeated throughout the series.
I don't know where else they say it. I remember.
I'm gonna have to check.
I remember coming upon this a couple years ago when I did a rewatch, like after Plus One aired, because I didn't think of it when I first saw Plus One. But then I rewatched Darkness Falls and I was like, what? Oh, my God. What? Like it was one of those things that I saw and then like it clicked in my head. I don't think that it's something that was an intentional parallel, but I do think that it's so in character for them that it feels that way. And I like that, like, if these are the only two times that this is said in the series, and I don't know, and if other people can give us like some, you know, receipts of other times that they have said this, I would love to see it. But I like that Mulder says it here and that Scully says it in Plus One. Back to him in a way, like it's and again, not intentional, but just a lovely little parallel. Like even when things are dire in this in this situation, we're gonna die, but whereas like in the other situation, it's more like about their relationship, and about like it's just such a nice progression when you think about how much has passed at that point. Just the idea that no matter what, they're gonna think of something, and I just love that.
I love it. Yeah, I love that. You know, that's, you can't ask for more in a partner than, no matter what, we don't know what we're going to do, but we know we're going to do something. And that's very reassuring. And, you know, I like the fact that Chris Carter wrote both of those episodes. Mm-hmm. And so this is something that he obviously very much associates with Mulder and Scully. And I mean, talk about a bookend, you know, season one to season 11 over a span of 20 odd years, you know, intentional or otherwise, it's a bookend as far as I'm concerned.
It works. This is what I always say, intentional or otherwise, it works. It's the intent is there and the sentiment is real. And I love it. I love it.
Yeah, it's there. And it's awesome.
So luckily they make it out alive here. I think it's a really cool shot how the light goes out and then they are both kind of afraid and then they turn around and realize that the sun has risen. I think it's a really cool little moment.
It's a great shot too of them in silhouette with just a little bit of daylight in the window behind them.
Yeah, a really, really nice direction, Joe Napolitano. Even though you quit, we think you did a good job.
Apparently,
So they do eventually get out because Spinny comes back. Nobody was expecting that, right? And Mulder was right.
Mulder's always damn right. It seems in this case, at least, he is.
Yeah. He says he's radioed for help. So I was going to ask you how the helicopter shows up at the end, but I'm like, obviously, because I didn't think their message got out from the cabin, but obviously Spinny has been able to radio for help. So is that how you read it?
I think that's how it is. Yeah, okay. That's kind of how I took it.
I also think though, and we'll get to this, but I also think that like the government knows exactly what they're looking for, too. So, I mean, it seems like they know exactly where to go. They know there's obviously a bunch of people there in hazmat suits. They know what to expect, you know? So it's just the whole rescue thing. But we'll get there. We'll get there. So this whole scene, this is one of the things that confuses me, because it's like, it feels like not a lot of time has passed since the sun rose, right? Mm-hmm. And then suddenly it's dark again. And I know that, like, we're supposed to believe that, like, the entire day has gone by, but I wish they had done something to kind of illustrate that, because I found myself getting very confused. I was like, so wait, have you been driving for 20 hours? I don't know what's happening. Like, because it was a weird cut, right? Was it just me or you? I mean, you had that reaction.
No, it was weirdly edited, and it took me a while to realize, oh, this bit when they're being attacked by the bugs, it actually is nighttime at that point. It was hard because the daytime is really quite dark as well, because it is kind of like, you know, rainy weather, etc. Yeah. So there's not like a huge distinction. If it had been like sunny during the day and then dark at night, it would have been a clearer distinction to me. It all kind of blurred together a little bit,
right?
And maybe could have been something that could have better conveyed the passage of time, because it does seem to be night all of a sudden. And it is a little confusing.
I mean, even somebody could have had a line where they were like, we've been waiting here all day, what are we gonna do? Because, like, you would think too, with all this daylight, that they would have attempted to begin to hike, you know what I mean? And they didn't. And it's just, it's all kind of, I don't know, yet again, just at the end here, slightly sloppy, but what are you going to do? So it's nighttime again. And they're still driving down the mountain, and the bugs show up, of course. And I think that the scene where Spinny is kind of getting attacked out in front of the headlights, when the headlights kind of go, I think that looks so cool. I don't know. And he did a good job of kind of like fighting off the fake bugs and like running off. I thought he did a really nice job.
Yeah. I had to kind of remind myself that every time someone was like acting as though they were being attacked by bugs, they were just literally just pretending that there were bugs there and there was nothing actually there. So kudos to really everyone in the episode for doing an excellent job of seeming to be attacked when they're just having to make the whole thing up. I think they did a fine job.
Yeah. On the flip side of that, though, I do think that there are moments where they should be flipping out and they're not. Like for example, like the moment when those bugs started coming into the car, they all look slightly shell-shocked, where I think that it would have been more like, shit, what do we do? Like, you know, it would have been more of a reaction, and then they do eventually get there, but it takes a while, and I'm always just like, y'all, you need to be a little bit more scared.
Yeah. I do. Yeah. I kind of wonder about the sort of the editing issue with that, and like the fact that, you know, they add the bugs in later, that maybe the timing was just a little off in terms of, maybe they didn't quite think that all the way through when they were shooting it, and who knows, maybe changed something in the post-production anyway. So things didn't quite line up as they ideally would have.
Yeah. And it didn't bother me, but it was just, I just found it kind of funny in a couple moments. Yeah. I was like, well, cause Scully, we saw like your very appropriate reaction back in the cabin, and then like it didn't feel like it translated here. I don't know.
As soon as the bugs started coming in through the vents, which was kind of a very cool sort of way that they had them getting into the vehicle, it was very scary. But as soon as I saw them, I would have thought at least there'd be a lot more unease. Like you said, maybe they were just meant to be just like in shock, because that's basically how they act. Everyone just kind of like, what do we do? And they're just almost like staring in wonder what's gonna happen next?
It's just,
well, you know what's gonna happen next.
It's very off. It just felt like it was not, they weren't quite, you know, in sync. So I just thought that was interesting. But and I think that this fade to neon green was a very interesting aesthetic choice. What do you make of this? I have to ask you. Like, it's so weird.
I don't know. I don't dislike it. I kind of like it, because we need to fade to something to kind of, you know, because again, there's quite a substantial bit of time and quite a lot has happened between the end of that scene and the start of the next, so we need to fade to something. They could have faded to black, but fading to green to me feels like that's the sort of like the POV of like Mulder and Scully. Like,
yeah.
Maybe that's what happens when you're attacked by the bugs. After a while, you just see this sort of green luminescence and that's all you see. So I was good with it.
Yeah. No, I do not. I don't dislike it. I don't think I ever really registered it before as like a thing that they did in this episode. And I was really kind of paying attention this time. And so it was just kind of stuck out to me as just something unusual that I don't think the X-Files really ever did anything quite like that ever again. So I don't know.
Yeah. It's an interesting creative choice.
Yeah. That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But so these the helicopters show up, the guys in these hazmat suits, like clearly they know what they're coming for. Like they know they're coming for some sort of something that's airborne, something that they could catch.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like they know.
And they're prepared.
Yeah, totally. And so they arrive and then we see everyone kind of covered up in web. And I remember thinking the first time I watched it, which would have been, you know, later than you did. But like the first time that I watched it thinking like, well, how are they going to get out of that? Like, I mean, because they look dead, you know, and I remembered thinking, well, they can't be dead.
Yes.
So they're in deep trouble. But then like they make a point to show that like they're moving. And I think that was an interesting thing to do. But like at the same time, like there were a few moments there that I was like, what? Like, I was like, wait. They're dead.
Well, like, yeah, I mean, like every time we've seen the bugs attack anybody, they're dead pretty fast.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Spinny seems to be, you know, taken by the bugs fairly quickly. So I'm still a little baffled as to why they weren't dead, because there's every reason to believe that they should have been, I think. So, I mean, I'm glad they're not, but it always seemed really odd to me.
Yeah. I mean, and clearly Spinny couldn't have gotten far, right? Like he was running. But
no.
Yeah. And we don't even really find out his fate. Like, I'm going to assume he died. But like they literally got eaten like 2 seconds after him. So it's like if they were all okay, then I'm sure Spinny could have been okay, too, if they got to him in time. I don't know. Maybe because he ran off into the woods. Maybe they just didn't find him. But I mean, like I said, he couldn't have gotten that far. I don't know. I was wondering.
No, I know. It's a little strange. I mean, I'm not sure. It might have been helpful for me if there'd been some kind of an explanation about why they survived and everybody else didn't. Like there was something different about what they were doing or where they were or something, because as it was, I was a little confused about why everybody else seemed to die so quickly and they survived.
Yeah, it was, I know, my only answer to that is because they're Mulder and Scully, but
yeah, I mean, and at the end of the day, it's good enough.
Right, it's good enough for me. And they do kind of say, they do say if we had gotten to her any later, like she could be dead. So I mean, I like the fact that they say that.
Yeah.
And
it could just be a timing thing in terms of the rescue.
Yeah. And again, we don't know. I mean, it was obviously dark, but we don't know how long they were in the dark. We don't know what time it was exactly. So, I mean, I guess a lot of that can be sort of fudged. So let's talk about this last scene in the containment facility here. This guy, I don't know who this actor is, and I don't mean to sit here and like drag this actor, but like, why is he talking like that? Like, he's talking like a robot, right? Like,
I know the whole scene is weird.
It's like, very weird.
Are we supposed to think that he's acting weird? Like, is he supposed to be acting weird on purpose so that the viewer thinks, oh, this guy is shady and not telling the truth? Or I'm not sure what we're supposed to
I don't
think
either, because I feel like he doesn't start the scene that way, but he ends it that way. And so it's almost like this weird progression, like they're taking us through like this sort of, okay, well, they're helping them. So everything's good. At least they're helping them. And then Mulder comes in his like sad little cap and his oxygen tank, and he just looks like a mess. But he's coming in to check on Scully, of course. You need to make sure his Scully is okay. But the way that this guy's talking to him is it's kind of normal at first, and then by the time he gets to the end of it, when he's like, well, what's gonna go on, how are you gonna contain it, and he's like,
yeah,
we will, with a series of burns and blah 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 blah, and like he's talking literally like a robot. I don't know what this guy was thinking. And then he's like, failure is not an option, Mr. Mulder. And it's just so melodramatic. It's weird.
Weird. I know, to me, the only thing I could take from it is that we're supposed to draw from that he's being disingenuous in some way, or was it meant to be threatening?
Yeah.
I don't like trying to be CSM and really failing badly in terms of how he pulled it off. I'm not sure. I tend to draw from it that we're meant to think he's not behaving in like a normal friendly way, that there's something slightly sinister, but the slightly sinister just winds up coming off as weird and robotic.
Yeah, it was just such a weird choice, and I still don't know what to think of it. I really don't. Like, I can chalk it up to just kind of season one, kind of just trying to be over the top conspiracy-esque. Like, that's my only takeaway from this. It's just too bizarre. It's too bizarre.
Yeah, it's a little shaky in terms of, I mean, it's very open-ended. If we wanted to kind of, you know, turn it into a positive, I mean, The X-Files is all about the open-ended endings, and this is probably the most open-ended, considering Scully is still unconscious, for heaven's sake.
Right.
Poor Scully. We don't even get to see her regain consciousness, and there's this very weird, vague allusion to whatever the hell is going on out in the forest. And
yeah, no, I
there's
mean,
this very intensely spooky music as well.
Yeah.
And Mulder looking very, very concerned. And I think I think that they're just kind of like going all out. And, you know, like you say, it's still season one, and they're trying to sort of like see how far we can push it in terms of it being an ambiguous and sort of spooky ending. I think they did a much better job of that in other episodes. Even within season one, they did a better job of that with Ice in terms of, talking about what's being done to clean up and things like that. It's a lot more clearly established and clearly communicated. This one, I feel like they were trying to sort of like, let's do something really ambiguous so that, you know, everything seems really bad and weird, and we'll just see if we can get away with that. And I'm not sure it really worked.
Well, see, and I don't, just to be clear, I don't have a problem with the ending. I don't have a problem with the way they ended it. I was talking specifically about this man's performance, but I actually really like the way that it is like Ice. They basically are saying the same thing that they said in all of these, that it's been covered up. It's done. You can't go back. Mm. You can't find anything. It's over. And what I like, too, is that we've spent this entire episode listening to both sides of this argument. We've been listening to, you know, the environmentalists against the loggers, and we've been, okay, this little bit of drama, this fight. And at the end of the day, the government just comes in and torches it. And I mean, is that not emblematic of just life? It's just sort of at the end of the day, we can fight the good fight as long as we want, but it's always going to be the big power, the head. They're going to come in and they're just going to torch everything. Like, I don't know. I think it's really, I think that was what I really liked about this episode in terms of the themes of it. Like, what they're trying to say is that we little people on the ground, we can do everything we want. But at the end of the day, like, the government's just going to kind of swoop in and take care of it. And that's unsettling.
Yeah, I really like that. I like that point. And I feel like they could have hit even harder with that. Like, if I was to sort of have if I could, you know, do anything with this episode, I might have just played up that government part a little bit more, because it happens very quickly at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't get a lot out of it. I might have liked to have just had that go on a little bit longer, just to kind of get a clearer sense of, you know, that they are taking over and that they're in charge. But I think that's a really great point that you make, that, you know, here's these two sides that have their respective passions.
Yeah.
And they both care so much about the things that matter to them. And then, literally the government comes in and torches the whole thing. And the government, or some, you know, some subsect thereof. And it is an interesting sort of illustration of, you know, we can fight as hard as we want, but it's all out of our hands in the end anyway. You know, everyone loses because of these mysterious forces.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this was kind of a good, interesting, unique way to tell that story. Because, I mean, we obviously, I don't think we get the whole environmental type plot like this. I mean, we get a little bit of it again, and I think in Detour, like I mentioned before. But, like, I think they hit it pretty well here. And especially pretty early in the series. I mean, I think this is a really solid episode.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that doing anything about environmentalism is a tricky undertaking. But I think that on the whole, they did a pretty good job of trying not to be too hard on one side or the other. And I think it does. And it's not too preachy or anything like that. Like, you know, the points are made and not overstated, I don't think. So
I agree.
I think it's tempting to, I mean, I, And Chris Carter strikes me as a pretty environmentally conscious kind of guy. So I imagine it would have been tempting to go a little harder on the points that he would have wanted to make. But I think he did a good job of doing it in a pretty subtle way. Mm-hmm. And yet still the points still come through nevertheless. So I think, yeah, it's a really well done episode, generally speaking, with, you know, the odd little bit, of course, here and there, doing their best in difficult situations.
Yeah.
I think it's very solidly done. I love it as an episode.
Yeah. Well, I mean, do you have anything else to add about the episode?
I don't think so. I do sometimes wonder if it's slightly overlooked as an episode, because it is not dissimilar to other episodes from season one that are better known, like Ice. Mm-hmm. And so I think that maybe when folks think about Darkness Falls, they know as soon as you say, yeah, the one with the bugs, people remember the bugs. That's quite memorable and quite unique. But I think the episode is sometimes maybe overlooked a little bit for what a solid and enjoyable episode it is.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there were a lot of, you know, not dissimilar episodes around that time. But this one's really, when you just look at it in and of itself, it's a good episode. And it's just solid performances all the way around. Great dialogue, I think, from Chris Carter, and very, you know, cool, a cool monster for sure. I think it's a really good episode, and I mean, I'm a fan of season one anyway, and I think this is a great episode.
Yeah, everything you said except take out Scully's line about the tree rings and crazy robot guy at the end. Those are my two beefs with this one. But
I could go with that. Absolutely.
Okay, let's take it. We're always allowed to pick on like a couple little things that we would have rather.
Absolutely.
Know what? Solid episode, other than those two tiny little things. But
And it's got some great Mulder Scully stuff in it as well. So
it does.
If you haven't watched it in a while, definitely give it a watch. It's quite enjoyable.
I mean, if for anything, Mulder in the turtleneck and Scully in the parka is worth it.
Yeah. I mean, they just look very cute whenever they're wearing outdoorsy clothes.
They really do.
It's a terrific example of that.
Yeah. Well, let us know, guys, what you think about Darkness Falls or anything for that matter. XFD podcast. On Twitter. That's our thing. Right. Sorry. I had a little brain space, but that's definitely
at
our Twitter.
XFD podcast. Yeah,
thank
that's
you.
It. Yeah.
There's an app.
That's good. It was your turn. I made the mistake last time. So I'm glad that it was your turn this time.
There's an app there that I forgot, but you guys get it.
That's
you guys get it.
No.
The bugs have gotten to my brain. But thanks you guys for listening. And we will be back with you again on another episode of X-Files Diaries.
Bye.